This morning, America's First News starts right after this.
When shopping for car insurance, consider this. GEICO has been saving people money on car insurance for over 75 years. So if you're serious about savings, it's simple. Go to GEICO.com. After 75 years, they know how to save you money.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This morning with your host, Gordon Deal.
The men who changed the war. Good morning, I'm Gordon Deal, along with Jennifer Koschenka. On this Memorial Day Monday, May 30th, glad you're with us. Here's what we have for you this hour.
As we remember our war dead, a new book chronicles the sacrifices made by specific fighters in the Revolutionary War. It's called Washington's Immortals.
How to sound less nerdy. Cyber geeks are taking lessons on how to speak a language that the rest of us can understand.
Simple ways to help veterans if you're inspired by Memorial Day, like how to sponsor a therapy dog.
And what's a little Memorial Day talk without hot dogs? How about a little baseball park sampler? And the unique hot dogs you can find this season.
There's one in Miami at Marlins Park in Miami, and it is a char-grilled Miami Mex dog, and it's topped with chili con carne, Monterey Jack cheese, cilantro coleslaw, and jalapeno lime aioli, and it's wrapped in flour tortillas rather than a bun.
Good any time of day. Wall Street Journal reporter Ellen Byron on the variety of Major League Baseball ballpark hot dogs. Her report in about 20 minutes. Well, Memorial Day is here, a time when we honor men and women who died while serving in the U.S. military. Many Americans, as you know, observe Memorial Day by visiting cemeteries or memorials, holding family gatherings, or attending parades. Here's another way to spend some of that holiday time, by reading a new book from military historian and Iraq war vet Patrick O'Donnell called Washington's Immortals. It's the extraordinary story of the most important band of brothers, forgotten men who changed the course of American history. Patrick, give us some examples.
August 1776, the men in Washington's Immortals made a series of desperate bayonet charges against a house that was occupied by Lord Cornwallis at the time. And they created a gap in the British lines that allowed the bulk of the American army to escape that day. And in the Battle of Brooklyn, which is the largest battle of the American Revolution, the war literally hung in the balance, and it was a situation where the entire army could have been destroyed. But the sacrifices of these men helped save the American army that day, and then they fought through 8 long years of war. And this book is the first Band of Brothers style treatment of the American Revolution. So it's pretty much it's sort of a boots on the ground. Much of it is in their own words. Very cinematic treatment of the American Revolution, the entire war.
Interesting. So has there been any effort to really pinpoint where this mass grave is in Brooklyn?
The book has stimulated a tremendous amount of interest, and there is efforts underway by several organizations to start to, you know, to begin, trying to pinpoint it and use ground-penetrating radar, et cetera.
Right. Wasn't part of that scenario in Brooklyn, didn't that involve like opportunistic weather at the time, too, for that escape?
The escape you're referring to takes place about 3 days later, and it is one of the greatest escapes in world history, where the entire army is able to travel across the East River. The Marblehead men from Massachusetts assemble all the boats from Manhattan, and then they ferry the Washington's army, including the Marylanders, across the East River into Manhattan. And when you talk about the favorable weather, what happens is that miraculously this fog sets in at the right time as the evacuation is taking place at night, and it screens the army's movement across the East River and the British aren't able to detect it.
Incredible. What were some of these the unimaginable hardships that these guys went through? I know that's referenced in some of the notes here.
One of the things, I mean, many of these men, this is in my, I've written 7 books on World War II, 10 books total, and Washington's Immortal is my latest book, and it's many of these men in a 2.5-year period marched 4,600 miles throughout the entire South of this country. And they did it without tents, without shoes for the most part. Many of these men were not fed properly. They weren't paid. And they were doing it against the most adaptable army in the world at the time, as well as against fellow Americans. I mean, this is our first Civil War, where up to a third of Americans were actually loyal to the crown. So they were, we were fighting not only the greatest army in the world, but we're all fighting ourselves.
Right.
And that is an incredible hardship.
We're speaking with Patrick O'Donnell, military historian, also a soldier, and author of a new book, his latest, called Washington's Immortals, The Untold Story of an Elite Regiment Who Changed the Course of a Revolution. What were what you call these suicide missions that some of these guys were on, too?
The Marylanders were always at the tip of the spear. They were typically Washington's shock troops. This was an elite unit, and they were put in the inflection points of many of the major battles during the American Revolution. These guys fought in both the North and the South, and in all of pretty much all of the major battles of the Revolution, everything from Brandywine Creek up north to a place called Stony Point, where they were in a raid. And then during, in the South, at Guilford Courthouse, Cowpens in 96, which actually is taking place this week, the Battle of 96, which is on the Georgia-South Carolina border. But a lot of times, the Forlorn Hope were the first wave. And this, these men were called the Forlorn Hope because their chance of survival was practically nil. Many of the men in the Forlorn Hope were armed only with axes to cut apart the abatis, which was essentially like sharpened logs that were put in front of fortifications, and they had to chop through that so that the assault waves, the rest of the assault, could make it through.
Oh, wow.
And the men of the Forlorn Hope were only armed with axes to cut apart this, these logs. And, I mean, it's an incredible story of how these men were all volunteers for the most part. And it was considered a badge of honor to be part of the Forlorn Hope, even though your chance of survival was practically nil.
Thanks, Patrick. Patrick O'Donnell, military historian, Iraq war vet. The book is called Washington Immortals. I had to hear that two times for that to sink in when he referenced that over the course of 2.5 years, some of these guys marched 4,600 miles. No tents, no shoes, minimal food, no pay, and of course against the best military in the world. 13 minutes now after the hour. If you're looking to grow or relocate your business, there are three numbers you should know. 10, 2,000, and 6. 10 stands for Michigan's ranking as a top 10 pro-business state. 2,000 is the number of unnecessary regulations Michigan has eliminated in the last 5 years. And 6 stands for Michigan's rank for best entrepreneurial climate. All those numbers add up to the one state that is all that and more, Michigan. Go to MichiganBusiness.org to learn more. Thanks for spending time with us on this Memorial Day. How do you tackle stress and become mentally tougher if stress at home at work aren't enough, right? Maybe you're feeling it from the recent terror attacks in Europe. We're joined now by Dr. Andrew Whitman, a Marine veteran who has been teaching mental toughness for over 25 years. He's a guest lecturer at Clemson University and author of Ground Zero Leadership, CEO of You. Andrew, what's your message?
Yeah, well, when I speak to audiences around the country, what we do is, and even in the book, we hire each person to become CEO of themselves, with their job of getting their board of directors to act together for their betterment, not their detriment. And, of course, we all know the board of directors by the names of body, mind, and emotion. And in mental toughness, what we do, the whole point is like, who is running the boardroom? When you take a vote with yourself, Gordon, who's running the board? Who usually wins the vote, the body, the mind, or the emotions?
Yeah. Okay, so in this day and age, do you feel that you speak to people who are more stressed out than ever?
Oh, totally, and the numbers bear that out. I think a study just came out, the survey for the year, that we're under extreme stress, and it's going up and up and up every year.
And why?
Well, the whole definition of really stress is that we feel like we can't control, we don't perceive control in our lives, so things are just out of control. And I think that we're seeing that, especially since like 2007, people thought that they had control of their retirement, and then their 401ks got shot, and then there's just crazy stuff in the economy, and we feel like we're out of control, so the stress just goes through the roof when external factors put that pressure on us.
And okay, so that whole idea of stress and pressure, I heard somebody say that, and it may have been an athletics reference, but pressure is something you put on yourself. Is that true?
Absolutely. Stress is just like beauty. It's in the eye of the beholder. So yeah. I love stress and pressure. Like the more I get, I can't get enough. It's like my rocket fuel. It makes me perform better. But it's all how you look at it. Like it's just like beauty. It's in the eye of the beholder.
Right. So not everybody's definition is the same.
Right. I mean, yeah, exactly. It's your perception. It's what we call in mental toughness a truth, not a fact. See, facts are just information. A truth is our perception of the facts. So it's like some people would be stressed out doing your job, right? Talking to millions of people every day.
Yeah.
That would stress them out. But not you. It's not stressful. In fact, you love it. You can't get enough of it, right? So
right.
It all depends on what your point of view is.
Wow. We're speaking with Andrew Whitman. He's a former Marine, also a guest lecturer at Clemson University. He's got a book out called Ground Zero Leadership, CEO of You. And we're talking about mental toughness. All right. So what are kind of some of the basic lessons, I guess, that you offer from the book or for when you're speaking and where you're talking to the students at Clemson? What do you want them to know?
Here's the key thing is that we found out in the last decade how the brain works. We all take in 11 million bits of information per second, but only 126 bits of information go to the conscious mind for action.
Jeez.
And the way we pick that 126 is what our opinion is, what our mindset is, what our thoughts and feelings are. So, you know, if you think you can't do something or you feel like you're stressed, then your genius brain will go find all that information, sift through all that 11 million bits, find the exact 126 that prove, yep, you're stressed. So the converse is true. If you think that this is going to be a great day, this is going to be awesome, I can handle anything life throws at me, your brain will go to work and find the information that proves you also to be correct. You can handle it and you're not stressed.
If we can only tackle 126 bits, we may not be tapping very much potential, are we, in terms of brain capacity?
No, and that's the whole thing, is that your discard is confirmation bias is what we call it in psychology. We're literally discarding 99.9% of all the information we take in,
so we have
to really point that in the right direction.
All right, so in terms of reducing stress, if you wanted to give somebody a tip or two today, what do you say?
All right, so I would just say suspend your disbelief for just 2 minutes. Instead of saying that's impossible or I can't do it, say, okay, I get it, it's impossible. But if it were possible, if I could do it, how would I do it? If you just give yourself that 2 minutes of saying, how would I do it? It frees up your brain to go look for that information on how you can get out of whatever issue that you're in.
All right. Thanks, Andrew. Dr. Andrew Whitman. The book is called Ground Zero Leadership, CEO of You. 22 minutes now after the hour on This Morning. Your Memorial Day barbecues will at some point probably include talk about your favorite baseball team today. Here's how to add a little flavor to your conversation, right? You can't talk baseball without bringing up the subjects of hot dogs, at least when it comes to attending a game. Wall Street Journal reporter Ellen Byron has a look at how some stadiums are getting creative with how hot dogs are prepared. Ellen, what did you find?
Well, there is a company called Levy Restaurants that sells at 7 Major League Baseball stadiums around the U.S., and they go all out to try to create regional twists on the classic ballpark hot dog.
Nice. All right, so what kind of regional twists did you discover?
Well, there's one in Miami at Marlins Park in Miami, and it is a char-grilled Miami Mex dog, and it's topped with chili con carne, Monterey Jack cheese, cilantro coleslaw, and jalapeno lime aioli, and it's wrapped in flour tortillas rather than a bun. It's their way of incorporating a Caribbean twist on the classic American hot dog.
Wow. See, I never thought of the Monterey Jack on a hot dog.
And a flour tortilla, too.
Yeah,
now,
yes.
You know, when they describe it, it seems so obvious now.
Right.
There's also differences in what fans want. So in Chicago, for example, fans really insist on a steamed hot dog rather than a grilled one.
Hmm.
Whereas, you know, in Phoenix, they have a grilled dog, and it's wrapped in bacon and topped with pico de gallo, pinto beans, and a little mayonnaise. It's called a Sonoran dog, and it's basically a hot dog with a southwestern twist. Chicago fans are especially particular about hot dogs, both Cubs fans and White Sox fans, and Levy makes a Chicago dog that has a Vienna beef hot dog, and it's served on a poppy seed bun, and both the bun and the hot dog are steamed rather than grilled.
Oh, man.
The toppings go all out on that one, too, if you're interested in knowing more.
What you got?
They have onions, tomato wedges, a pickle sphere, peppers, celery salt, yellow mustard, and bright green relish. Apparently, the bright green color is a non-negotiable in Chicago.
If you ask for the hot dog without it, you're told to get out?
Exactly. It's got to be neon green, too. There's no artisanal, all-natural twist on that relish. It's got to be neon green.
That's great. We're speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Ellen Byron. Her piece is called Get Your Hot Dogs Here, a Ballpark Tour Ahead of the Start of the Major League Season. What else did you find?
In L.A., at Dodger Stadium, last year, this company, Levy's Restaurant, sold about 2.5 million hot dogs during baseball season at Dodger Stadium. And its regional twist on the hot dog there is a quarter-pound hot dog that's topped with pineapple salsa, and it's served on a sweet-tasting bun made from King's Hawaiian bread. And that hot dog strives to achieve, I guess, an extra sweetness combination to the salty garlic of the hot dog.
How about, did you say Washington, D.C.'s got chili?
So a favorite eatery there is Ben's Chili Bowl, and the company tries to bring in local favorite restaurants whenever possible. And so the Ben's Chili Dog there is a grilled pork hot dog on a steamed bun, and it's topped with mustard, onions, and chili from Ben's Chili Bowl. And so that's a specific flavor that locals are going to recognize and appreciate.
Thanks, Ellen. Wall Street Journal reporter Ellen Byron. 30 minutes now after the hour on This Morning, America's First News.
In business, risks and rewards come with every decision, like moving to the cloud with Office 365. While its benefits include anywhere access and lower costs, cyber threats and user errors can quickly wipe out data and the money you save. Barracuda Essentials for Office 365 provide an added layer of security and functionality for threat protection, email migration, data recovery, and quality of service. Move securely to Office 365. Visit barracuda.com/essentials to learn more.
America's First News is online all the time. Follow us on Twitter at This Morning Show. Like us on Facebook or send us an email. This Morning at CompassMediaNetworks.com.
Thanks for being with us on this Memorial Day Monday, May 30th. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koshinka. Coming up this half hour, cyber geeks going to school to become less nerdy. Also, why NBA players lie about their height and simple ways that you can help veterans. We'll have a list of ideas in about 20 minutes. Young adults determined to pay off student loans or commit to a life of minimal debt are showing more and more interest in so-called tiny homes. There are now an estimated 10,000 of them in the U.S. While that's not a big number, it's up from just a couple of hundred less than 5 years ago. More on the trend from USA Today business reporter Charisse Jones. Charisse, what have you discovered?
I discovered that it's very popular with baby boomers, but millennials are the other group that are really gravitating towards this tiny house living.
And that's significant because this is right now the largest generation by pure numbers, right?
Absolutely. I mean, they just surpassed baby boomers in terms of numbers. And, you know, right now it's kind of a fledgling trend. I mean, just a few years ago it was a couple hundred, and now it's about 10,000. But that's still an exponential leap. And with the, you know, the way it's infused pop culture, with the shows, there's a conference that's held every year now that speaks to this lifestyle. It's something that is really growing, and it taps into a lot of buttons for millennials. You know, these are young people who often have a lot of student debt. They lived through the recession, and they saw their parents struggling to hold on to their homes and their jobs, and they don't want to be burdened in that way. They don't want to be, you know, chained to a desk or a job that they don't like. They want to be able to pick up and move when they want, and they don't want a huge mortgage hanging over their heads. And so tiny house living really helps to alleviate a lot of those issues.
Where do we typically find these homes, Charisse?
It's primarily in California, Oregon, kind of warmer climates. Down south, North Carolina, you're seeing a lot more of them. It's not as prevalent in the Northeast, even though it is budding. There were people we spoke to in Massachusetts. Sometimes in upstate New York, you'll find some tiny homes, and in Pennsylvania. But it's really something you see more out west and down south.
Yeah. So are these homes typically part of some sort of development, or are they one-offs somewhere?
You know, that's the tricky thing. They tend to be one-offs because a lot of towns don't really have regulations yet to kind of govern this kind of housing, and people feel kind of uncomfortable with them. It's kind of like, not in my backyard, you know, like, well, who's living in these small spaces? And so there's still a little ambivalence about it. So people tend to build these homes on wheels so that they can kind of pick up and relocate if they have any problem. They might live in a person's backyard. For older folks, like baby boomers, they might live in back of their kids or their grandkids. So it's kind of a mobile lifestyle, even though they really do want to be stationary. It's just difficult to find a permanent spot to settle down in a lot of parts of the country.
Well, we're speaking with Charisse Jones, national business correspondent at USA Today, and we're taking a look at her story about tiny homes and the trends here for the millennial generation, which seems to have embraced them. So what are the positive, and well, you mentioned some of the positives, what are some of the negatives?
Well, it's hard to entertain when you only have a few hundred square feet, so you're probably not going to be able to have a lot of people over. And it can be a hard lifestyle. I mean, again, you have to relocate if the town finds out where you are and doesn't like you being there. A lot of times you might have to, say, have a composting toilet, you know, so you're having to, you know, haul water and empty out the bathroom facilities. It can be very cold. One of the guys that I spoke to talked about how, because it is so small, even though he had solar panels, being in the Northeast, it was getting below zero during the winter, and he literally had to sleep in his loft inside of a sleeping bag with his coat on. So it can be a little bit rustic and a little bit rugged, but for people that embrace the lifestyle, they feel that the positives outweigh the negatives.
Wow.
Because it's something that might take you $5,000 or $10,000. It's something you can actually build yourself. So all of those things kind of intersect to make this lifestyle much more appealing.
Thanks, Charisse. Charisse Jones, national business correspondent at USA Today. 20 minutes now before the hour on This Morning, America's First News. Thanks for spending part of your Memorial Day with us. Information security leaders are hired to keep hackers from stealing a company's data, right? But before they can do that, they face another challenge, getting their message across. Now they're moving into the C-suite, briefing boards and the public on high-stakes breaches. A big part of the strategy, making cybersecurity easier to understand. MarketWatch reporter Priya Anand says they're dropping the nerd talk, something not so easy for people with techie backgrounds. Priya, what's up?
So people who work in cybersecurity and really technical fields like this, part of the problem for them right now is that their work is becoming so much more prominent as large companies like Target, Sony, et cetera, all get hacked, and everyone's looking for a chief information security officer to run their security operations. The problem that these people are running into, though, is that they were normally, you know, just working with their IT staff and security vendors and things like that, and now they're having to do things like present to the board or talk to the public or give comments to reporters. And so what they're finding challenging is this whole idea of translating their work and having people actually understand what they're saying. When you have 5 minutes in front of a boardroom, a corporate board, to tell people, hey, this hack happened at a competitor, here's what we need to do to make sure it doesn't happen here, you want to make sure you're actually saying things people actually understand and you're getting out of the jargon. So there's a course now at Carnegie Mellon that's trying to help people do that.
Interesting. All right, so what are they teaching then?
Yeah, it's a communications course. It's part of this whole Chief Information Security Officer program that they've developed to give people in security basically more ability to talk business strategy, right, and do that business speak that everyone does in a corporate boardroom and use their kinds of terms instead of using really technical terms that people might not understand. And it sounds really silly to say, you know, don't assume anyone knows anything, but people in the security world often do assume. So one of the things they're teaching these people is, look, break it down from the basics when you get to a boardroom.
We're speaking with MarketWatch reporter Priya Anand. Her piece is called Cyber Geeks Are Going to School to Become Less Nerdy. All right, so are there examples of typical jargon or insider phrases that tend to make our eyes glaze over?
Mm-hmm. If you're reading a cybersecurity story or hearing about it on the radio from us even, when people say malware, let's give you a simple definition. Malicious software is what that stands for. So it's usually software that tries to take control of a computer or damage it or destroy it in some way or steal information, do something bad to a computer, basically. And everyone hears about phishing these days, phishing with a PH. Phishing is an attempt to trick a user into giving away information, usually login credentials, banking credentials, login credentials to a corporate network, by getting them to oftentimes click on a link that looks like it's maybe from your bank or looks like it's a legitimate attachment or something of that sort, and then it infects their computer or it sends them to a page that then says, enter your login credentials here, but really it's a fake page set up by a criminal to steal those login credentials, and you're not actually logging into a legitimate site. So that's what phishing is. It's someone basically trying to, like, fish for your information and steal your information.
How long is this Carnegie Mellon course or certification that they offer? How long does it take?
It's a six-month program. Some of the people who do this course are actually already chief information security officers or work in the security field usually. About one-third of the people usually have these high-level roles already. But oftentimes you're not necessarily reporting to a board if you have one of these roles. So it really is about, you know, once you're taken out of the back IT room, once you're out from behind the desk and you're talking to people, here's how you can be more convincing. Here's how you can be a business leader in addition to having these credentials as a security.
Thanks, Priya. Market Watch reporter Priya Anand. Our tech update has been brought to you by Dell. Make your work beautiful again and reduce downtime by 50% with powerful new Dell and Intel technology. Learn more at Dell.com/business. It is 12 minutes now before the hour on This Morning, America's First News.
A great business needs a stunning website. And with Wix.com, you can do it all by yourself. Wix.com makes it easy to look amazing online, no matter what type of business you're in. Show off your images in a beautiful gallery, grow your contact list, and get all your social media in one place, just the way you want. Your customers are going to love it. So, what are you waiting for? Show the world what you can do. Go to Wix.com and create your stunning website today. It's easy and free.
Thanks for being with us. NBA game programs across the country are full of inaccuracies when it comes to player height, even the ones available in the playoffs. The widespread misrepresentations highlight a funny thing about the NBA. Its players, despite being taller than most of the other 2.7 billion men on Earth, lie about their height like everyone else. Here's this morning's Jennifer Koshenka.
Is it possible to grow a few inches or even shrink a few inches during a basketball season? Apparently so. Some NBA players are lying about their height. Chris Herring of the Wall Street Journal explored this phenomenon and has more. Chris, you say Kevin Durant, for one, lies about his height. How did that all come about?
Well, he's clearly not 6'9". I mean, he's been pictured with teammates who are 6'10", 6'11", some cases 7 feet, and he either towers over them or is standing, toe-to-toe with those guys. So it was pretty clear he was never 6'9", at least not with basketball shoes. And that's kind of the thing, is that Kevin Durant goes by a measurement where he's without shoes, whereas the rest of the league uses them with shoes, and there's no mandate on those players to use a certain measurement. So that's kind of how he gets away with it.
Chris, your story talks about a couple of other players that are close to 7 feet or over 7 feet and don't want to be known as seven-footers. How come?
The same thing, honestly. Kevin Garnett was kind of the first guy, at least in this generation, to really eschew that sort of thinking in terms of not wanting to be listed as a seven-footer. He told his coach to call him 6'13", which was kind of a dead giveaway that he's obviously taller than 7 feet. But he's listed at 6'11", and so obviously he's listed right underneath the 7 feet mark, even though he's taller than that. But before that, I think, it was especially before we reached the modern era of basketball, we started having guys 7'3", 7'4", 7'5", like Yao Ming. People just thought that they looked awkward, and they felt kind of like freaks and abnormal being so much taller than not only the general population, but also other basketball players. And so being listed at 7 feet only added to that, where, we talk about how tall certain guys are, and then for some reason, once you get past 6'11", certain guys have had a stigma, thinking that they draw extra attention, before you even get to look at them in a game. When you look at the program for a game or something like that, they stand out like a sore thumb because they're actually 7 feet tall, so you almost look for that person as soon as the game starts.
This morning's Jennifer Koshenka with Chris Herring from the Wall Street Journal. 6 minutes now in front of the hour on This Morning, America's First News. Ledger with us. Most Americans will never serve in the military or fight for their country, yet there are countless ways that everyone can help these veterans who often return home from war to face their most difficult battles. CNN has 9 simple things you can do to make a difference. We've got time for a handful of them. Number one, give a veteran a ride. Disabled American Veterans provides free transportation to men and women who can't travel to VA hospitals on their own. You can volunteer to drive a van. Number two, donate your frequent flyer miles. Number three, sponsor a companion dog for veterans with PTSD. Puppies Behind Bars is a program in which prisoners train companion dogs for veterans with PTSD. Number four, help build a home for severely injured vets. Check out Building Homes for Heroes. Number five, keep veterans off the streets. Help with homelessness by helping a stand-down program, as it's known, through your local VA hospital. Number six, send a care package or a letter. For that, visit Operation Gratitude. And finally, help them take flight with the Honor Flight Network. You can volunteer to escort them. Of course, share your stories and say thank you. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koschenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Morning, America's First News.